Hello and welcome to the Customer Insight Leader Podcast. Data, analytics, big data science, machine learning, customer insight, behavioral science, blockchain, data ops, data engineering, agile working. Phew, too many terms, too many things to think about. Do you as a leader need somewhere to turn? To hear what other leaders are doing? To hear what really makes a difference in your business? Welcome. The Customer Insight Leader Podcast is here for you. Each episode, we'll be interviewing a different leader in the fields of customer insight, data, and analytics to hear what they really do, what really makes a difference. So settle down, get that cup of coffee, and enjoy the Customer Insight Leader Podcast. Hello and welcome to the Customer Insight Leader Podcast, a place to hear from today's leaders in the fields of customer insight, data science, and analytics. I'm your host, Paul Loughlin, and with me today is Adam Stroker. Adam is Head of Machine Learning Engineering at Origami in the UK. I'm sure we'll hear more about them from Adam, but Origami provides trading and automation software for short-term power energy trading. So a very topical focus, actually, in these days of soaring energy prices. Before joining Origami, Adam has worked as a research engineer and a data scientist at several Scottish firms, and was data and AI director at the IT consultancy Incremental Group. Adam describes himself as an experienced data and AI leader, helping organizations unlock value from their data by delivering enterprise scale solutions and building high performance data teams. So he sounds ideal for this podcast. Welcome, Adam.
Thanks for having me, Paul.
Very good to have you with us. I know we met via a kind of data leaders gathering online of a Scottish community. I should also mention to listeners that Adam is actually Dr. Stroker. Yes, that's right. He's another one of my guests with a PhD, just to make me feel that little bit inferior. So it'd be interesting to learn how his academic depth as well as his practical experience have helped him. But let's begin in our traditional fashion. Adam, as you're probably aware, I ask every guest on this podcast to tell us their background, where they're coming from, if you like, so listeners understand their career story. So could you tell us a bit about your background and how you got into the world of data science?
Yeah, certainly. So I always start this a little bit further back than most people, but I think it's relevant and you'll see why. So okay. Yeah, way back in the midst of time, I went to university to do chemistry and I didn't love it, is probably fair to say. During that time, I became very interested in bartending, as many students do. I went on to become a cocktail bartender and do cocktail competitions. So we're traveling around the UK and Europe, making drinks for a living and getting to see loads of lovely places and things like that, which is great fun and really was my passion. I soon realized that I wasn't ever going to sort of make enough money to own a bar by working in one because I wasn't that good. I mean, so I decided to go back to university to do a bit of a transition from chemistry to physics and in hope that I'd eventually get a proper job. So I did a physics master's at the University of Manchester. And it was towards the end of that, I first started coding microcontrollers for energy scavenging devices. Very cool. So my very first programming language was C, actually. So everything else seemed pretty easy after that. I realized I'd love that. And I went on to do computational physics as a doctorate. And I really wanted to work in industry, not just academia. So for ease and brevity, I tell everyone I've got a PhD because most people don't actually understand what an Eng is. So I don't have a PhD at all. I have an engineering doctorate, which is ever slightly different. And they're quite cool and worth pursuing. I think they should be more popular because you work full time at an organization in a research capacity, but you can submit some of that research to a university and then go and defend it and get a doctorate that way, which is what I did. So I think that's given me a lot of unique insights or different insights to the traditional kind of academic PhD. So I did that Eng at Thales Optronics up in Glasgow, doing computational physics for the lasers team there. That was really good fun building all sorts of models and systems to help their big product development. So I got a lot of experience in massive research programs and research teams that have been going on years. I was a very small cog in a very, very big machine, which was quite interesting. It was towards the end of that that I started exploring reinforcement learning systems for designing lasers, and had some success and absolutely fell in love with some of the tools I was using, like machine learning and some of the processes around data science. Mm. And it was about that time I'd kind of realized I didn't actually care that much about the domain. I just loved doing numbers on the computer, I would say. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, right, and I discovered machine learning, and I thought, right, data science will be the thing I want to pursue. Mm-hmm. And having decided I didn't quite like these massive battleship companies, I wanted to work for a small and swift dinghy of a company. So startups it was. I found a really cool startup in Bridgeton in Glasgow called Clear Returns that focused on the returning behavior of online shoppers, essentially. Okay. Really, really cool product. And based on the fact that I think it was quoted that 30% of all online sales get returned. And actually, if you do some clever segmentation, you can identify negative lifetime value customers quite quickly and then therefore not market to them and not sell to them and things like that. So that was really interesting. The challenge with it was, though, the only kind of route to selling our service was to convince sales directors and such to stop selling to certain people, which never goes down well. So it was quite a hard road in. I moved from there to an insurance firm working in a pricing team. That was super cool. And some of the stuff that it's actually really eye-opening about the information these insurance firms have on you and some of the stuff they know and can infer from the vast amount of data you put into price comparison websites and stuff. So did some cool stuff there around price optimization and looking at customer segmentation again there. And after a while, just moved on to Incremental Group. And that's kind of where my career really changed. I had been, data scientist, individual contributor for a while at this point. Mm. And I was so there at Incremental at first. And then they wanted to restructure the company and spin up business units, one of which to be dedicated to data and AI. And I got the opportunity to lead that. So they promoted me to director. And that was a really interesting transition, incredibly painful to go from individual contributor to manager, managing people that were my peers, learning a lot about the corporate side of running a business. And the way the business unit director role worked there was you were kind of like mini CEO within a larger support network of the kind of core functions of the business. So you kind of made all of the decisions with support from the exec, but lots of room to make mistakes, and I made a fair few and learned a lot on kind of trial by fire.
Of course.
That was a success, and we kind of tripled in revenue in the first year, and we grew from 3 to about 8, and towards the end of I ended up with another team as well towards the end of my time at Incremental, and had really, kind of got into the hang of lots of the hiring stuff, the strategy, the longer term, dealing with everything from sales and marketing through to performance management, things like that. And I always said it was kind of my dream job. And then Origami came along and just, I really loved what they were doing. And it was, we can maybe get into this a bit later, but the idea that there's such a heavy, kind of messy, complex data problem in the energy industry. And to me, as a bit of a dreamer and a bit of a technologist, like I can see the solutions and I've used the tools that will solve the problem. It's just about the doing and about forging the path through it. So I was really excited to join them and help them scale up their AI team, do more machine learning and do machine learning in a way that was less academic and like ad hoc. I think data science in particular, a lot of people have been burned by sort of investing in it and maybe getting in PhDs and things like that, doing some of the early stuff and then finding it's really, really difficult actually to deploy it to production, to scale it.
Yeah.
Really derive value from it regularly and frequently and bake it into their business as usual. And that's why the head of machine learning engineering is a bit of a weird job title because there aren't, it's still quite a new field, but it's totally right. It's the right thing to be focusing on to essentially empower the business to go from doing some models to doing hundreds of thousands of models and production and things like that. And that's where I am now. So yeah, just building that team out and building out some of those capabilities. I said just before we started recording, I'm writing stuff about roadmaps, and I've been doing a lot of work on frameworks and stuff at the minute. It's good fun.
Good. Thank you for sharing that, Adam. I've got to pick up on, partly because of my insurance background and all the insurance colleagues and contacts I've got, you're during that, you're describing the time you spent in an insurance company as super cool. That's going to be a unique quote about someone working in an insurance company. But I guess I was struck during a lot of the career story you shared with us, though, Adam, how much you talk about this is really fascinating, this is cool, this is super cool, this is fun, this is... You enjoy what you do, don't you? There seems to be a passion that threaded through that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I jump out of bed in the morning to do this stuff. Like, I'm a complete nerd, always have been. Doing numbers at the core of what I do is doing numbers on the computer, which is fun anyway. I'm a big like gamer, like computer games, board games and things like that. Yeah. And so I like the challenge and the intellectual, it scratches that intellectual itch and curiosity for me. And then origami, especially, like at the same time, I can deliver value and do something with a bit of social impact as well. Yes. But even like in consulting, you're going in and you're helping businesses solve problems that they've maybe not come across the answers to yet. So I really enjoy what I do, and it's like it's great when you see an impact from like the outputs, and you take something big and complicated and sort of unknowable to someone and turn it into something that delivers value and that they can make sense of.
Yeah, completely agree. Yeah, no, that is great to hear, Adam. Not just the sort of success of the nerds, but the people finding their niche and throwing themselves into it with passion and getting better and better at what they do. It's as a coach and a mentor, let alone someone working this field, it's always delightful to hear. So it's a good way to approach life, Adam. I think I'd also agree with you on the point you kind of alluded to toward the end there, that actually a lot of firms end up frustrated with their use of data science, because it doesn't really end up being deployed in ways that create measurable value soon enough, and often ends up discredited and not used. And it's funny enough, the last guest I had on this podcast, Stuart, was talking about how most firms don't need this. And he thinks it's kind of a myth that the most firms need it. And I think there is a truth between what you're both saying, that you found somewhere where there is a real need and you can make a real difference. But it's not about pretending every organization needs a head of machine learning engineering, because that isn't the reality out there. Would you agree?
Yeah. So this used to sound really bad when I ran a consultancy, but I do believe in it. It was actually the reason I joined Incremental was... From my experience and what I'd heard about, like in meetups and across the industry, I actually thought that short targeted projects delivered by consultants would be far more valuable than an organization trying to find its feet, say like a construction organization, right? That hiring in a first, like their first data scientist and letting them loose on things. I found that was often more expensive and slower. And riskier than spending a little bit more money for a short amount of time, but getting experts in that have almost a cookie cutter approach to delivering value that you can hold to account and things like that. And so that's why I went into consultancy, because I thought those smaller projects where you can do a 12-week thing, deliver it, and then take a step back and let the organization like breathe with it a bit and figure out does it fit, do they want to extend it? I think that's a good approach. It sounded really bad when I was in a consultancy. But for some organizations, there's others where I can see AI and data science and machine learning and analytics is absolutely at the core of the value for them. I think that's true for Origami. Like, it is core to what we do. So it totally makes sense for us to really double down on it and invest big, significantly in it. But for a lot of firms, that isn't, it's an aside or it's a nice to have. So low risk exploration.
Yeah, that makes good sense. I love that term, breathe with it. So it's a good one. Okay, let's not walk past, though. Fascinating mention at the beginning of career story, because one of the things I want from this podcast is a diversity of guests. And not everybody talks about a passion of being a cocktail bartender and getting as good as you can at that. So look, let's dwell on that a bit. Looking back, do you see that as having taught you transferable skills that have helped you later in your career? Or was it just a bit of fun at the beginning?
No, totally. Like, I attribute some of my success actually to it. I learned Because, yeah, look, I've always been a nerdy person, but I worked with some really good bartenders and managers that were super charismatic. Like the whole room would sit and listen to them. So I learned a lot of skills about like charisma, confidence, and how to start and carry conversations, how to explain. Because look, in a bar setting when everyone's drunk, cocktails are quite complicated to people, right? They're not when you're sat here at your desk and sort of, clear-minded. But being able to explain what you're doing and why you're doing it and talk to people, I find them really useful skills that have carried over. Like, I find a lot of people in my role that have maybe done a PhD and are very academically minded, that's not a natural skill set for them to be able to walk into a room like a boardroom and start giving a presentation on why they're doing something. And there's a big piece around communicating at the right level as well and not getting too techie. Like we all love the technology and we love getting into the details, but the vast majority of your audience don't. And you need to catch that before you kind of lose yourself in it, I think. So yeah, no, look, I think bartending has kind of given me a unique set of skills that it'd be interesting to see other routes of learning that stuff other than going and working bars.
No, absolutely. Thank you. That makes good sense. And I can absolutely see the wisdom of it. I mean, as you know, I think I spend a not insignificant part of my time training technical teams in softer skills and kind of developing. So I completely agree with your comment about it's not always natural to the more introverted, nerdy stereotype of analysts and data scientists. Do you think there was something particularly special about bartending, or do you think that's just the one that worked for you? And it might help a whole range of people who are thinking about a technical career to also spend some time in a kind of customer-facing role, in that role where they're going to learn some of those interpersonal skills?
So it's hard, isn't it? I suppose from my experience, I can see some of the ingredients that made it special for me. If you work in a very busy bar, building complicated drinks and things like that and taking complicated orders, then there's actually quite a lot going on at once. You've got to face-to-face tend to the people that are actually at the bar and speak to them, carry conversation. You typically have to do quite a lot of arithmetic in your head where you add up orders and costs and things like that. I got really good at mental math at the time there because it allows you to go quicker. You've got to remember what you're doing with your hands at the same time. And people are always asking you, like, why are you putting egg in my drink? And they think it's disgusting. And you have to explain the reasoning for using egg in what doesn't look like an egg drink and things like that. So, yeah, I think I can see kind of you add all that up and it's a complicated, high-pressure environment that you have to think on your feet and things like that. And again, it makes you kind of being charismatic is directly correlated to tips as well. So there's like a being funny, to trying to make people feel like you're really listening to them as well. That's the other one, is listening to people, what they want, things like that.
Makes sense. You're definitely selling it. We'll be creating the degree program, including cocktail bartending, I'm sure. Let's also dwell then on the other thing that was unique about you, Adam, compared with other guests I've had on, this understanding of the ENGD. Thank you for calling that out. It is all too easy, and I made the mistake of, even though I knew you had that, translating a doctor into, that's PhD. But you mentioned when you were completing your engineering doctorate that it was while working commercially, not just kind of staying in a purely academic setting to do that. I wonder, would you recommend that route to others working in data science, or do you think there was a peak where people needed PhDs or ENGDs, and now there's enough kind of masters of data science people out there and they can just get on with doing the work in a business? Do you think it's worth going to the doctorate level, I guess I'm asking?
So this is a big, I think, very multifaceted question, actually, that you can come at from a few angles. So start with, data science is a very overloaded term. And back when I started, it was the only route in, actually, because whenever a new job pops up, they typically go, right, I'm technical, let's make sure you have to have a PhD to get in. So when I started, you had to have one to start doing it. And there weren't master's courses and things in it. Coursera was like one of the only places you could go and learn online. So at the time, it made sense. But it yeah, you can now do masters in it. You can now transfer into it in a quicker route. Mm. I would say don't do a doctorate if you don't love the subject matter, because they are difficult, and there's quite a lot of sort of research out there, and most people will tell you that mental health can really suffer and things through it. They get tricky and they get hard for people to get through the middle of. So you have to think about what does like a research qualification, like a doctorate, because that's what it is. It's training you to do research. What does that give you as a professional? Well, the ability to lead research and to do that exploratory stage really well and do it in a repeatable manner that supports finding value and not just like looking at hunches. Does every data scientist need that? Well, that's where I think the overloaded term becomes a problem. There's lots of different types of data science to be done these days. There's what I would call the kind of the research scientists that are finding new algorithms and things like that. Yeah, certainly you probably need a PhD to do that stuff, to do it well. If you're at the other end of the spectrum, there's people that are applying tried and tested techniques to kind of business as usual problems. I think, no, you don't need research expertise to do that. So. Yeah. What am I saying? I think there's a place for everyone. I think if you're interested in being able to lead research, but you want to work in industry, then I'd say that an industrial doctorate is incredibly valuable. I love the NGD program. And one of the big benefits of it is because you do a master's at the same time, essentially. You do 180 credits of taught work.
Oh, and
we did a lot of stuff with Edinburgh Business School. So I've done a lot of MBA units as part of my NGD, I didn't live and breathe it for a while, but when I went into the director level role, then I kind of knew some of the terminology. I knew a little bit about accounting, a little bit about finance, a little bit about project management that empowered me to have conversations with those kind of stakeholders. So the NGD was really, really good. That's the one that I went through. And there's loads of doctoral training centers across the country that will do them in all sorts of fields. So not sure is the answer, I suppose. Yeah. It really depends on what your goal is. But I certainly think I've worked with incredible data scientists that don't have a doctorate. And sometimes I think it can be a hindrance as well, because it can train you to be too academically minded and maybe not too focused on like time frames and delivering short bits of value and working with other stakeholders and things like that.
Yeah, completely agree, Adam. Thank you. That was a nicely nuanced answer. And I think you're right to pull apart those two ends of the spectrum and help people through that thought process as to whether a PhD or an NGD would actually suit where they want to focus. Because like you, I've certainly come across data scientists and data science leaders who've in some ways gone too deep academically, and it hinders their conversation and their influencing of very commercially minded business leaders in the organization. They're coming from a mindset of seeing it as an interesting theoretical problem, and other people are on the spike for sales numbers or other commercial targets, and it's too difficult a chasm to breach for some of those people.
So that ties into something I used to always say to people that I was kind of bringing on in the team. I was like, no one cares about your F1 score or your accuracy or your precision. No one actually cares. So at every number that you report into pound coins or seconds, and if you can turn the seconds into pound coins, that's better, because that's the language that every kind of business unit will speak, every function will speak, and it will make sense. It's hard to do, but don't get too techie with people that aren't your immediate peers, I'd say.
Yeah, absolutely. It's all about the so what. It's all about the impact and the decision that can be made to make a practical difference in the business. Absolutely. Completely agree. The other thing you shared with us, and thanks for sharing your career story, Adam, was you emphasised the difficult transition between being a hands-on practitioner to that management role. Having now operated as a leader and a technical doer, and kind of, as it sounded like, sometimes switch between those hats, I wonder what your advice would be for those who are facing that challenge for the first time, because there'll be plenty of data scientists or other technical analysts maybe facing this transition to they've been asked to manage a team, lead a team, and there's a range of pitfalls there, as you'll know. What would your advice be to them as to how you can best make that transition?
Yeah, it's difficult. I think seeking help early on and not just putting your hand up saying I'm stuck. I mean, find a mentor, find someone that you've either had that was a good manager or leader, or someone that you admire that you maybe not worked with, and ask them for your time. One of the beautiful things about the data community is how collaborative it is. And if you can't find someone in your network, then join things like, there's plenty of communities out there, and ping me to find out about some of them. But find a mentor that's going to give you some time and that you can just bounce like scenarios off of, and they'll talk through you. That's really helpful. With your team and your peers, I think be really open and honest, and just say, look, I am learning this, and I'm spending time and energy trying to learn to be a good leader, a good manager. Please bear with me. Tell me if you think things are unfair, if you think things aren't right. Do your best to listen to people. But you don't have to take it all on board is the other thing. Like, there, you will make mistakes, but at the same time, there are some difficult people that you just won't gel with, and it won't work out with. It's hard to identify that early on, and that can cause a lot of pain. And you'll look back in hindsight and think, that was my fault, or think, no, actually, confidently, I can say that wasn't me. You have to just get through it. And I think being open and honest and seeking help. And there are good management books out there. Like, some of it's a bit, it's one of these overloaded fields where there's a bit too much guidance, but there are some that are quite good and quite useful to read and learn. And it's about taking in as much information as possible and then making it your own and trying stuff and seeing what works.
Yeah, that makes sense, Adam. Thank you for sharing that. Of course, from my perspective, I've also mentioned the option of an external mentor as well. But I agree. I think that can be so helpful. And I think you're right to emphasize the listening skills. I think it can be so easy, and this is true of even more senior leaders that I mentor, to, with all the knowledge and the experience you've built up, particularly as a technical leader in such a technical field as you work in, to be tempted to always solutionize, always direct. And I think shifting gear to coaching questions and listening to members of your team can sometimes be a difficult transition for leaders like yourself, who can almost feel like they're not giving full value unless they tell people what the answers are. Have you managed to make that transition and kind of ask coaching questions more?
Yeah, and it's one of the things that I think it's a hard thing to realize and come to terms with, but it's now, like, I truly believe it is the idea that I want to do the technical stuff. Everyone does. It's fun, right? But actually, if I could put out 5 work units a week, right? But I can get in 2 super genius people that can do 10 each.
Yeah.
But actually, they won't work well together. If I can be the glue that gets them to collaborate and do things as a team, we'll put out 40 work units a week between us, right? Yeah. That's almost always the case. And so I can have more of an impact and be more powerful in what I deliver by smoothing that team dynamic and making sure that people are working together effectively, or if they're not, mixing them up with other people or separating them and making sure that they're given, basically your job is to take all the obstacles out of the person's way and then empower them to do their best work, I think. And it's about realizing that you don't have to do everything. And then also, it's all right for people to do stuff not as well as you might have done it.
Yes.
Because that's actually the way that you both learn, because sometimes you'll be surprised that it will be better than you'd have done it when the outcome is realized. But if it's not, then it's a great opportunity for you to coach the person and show them, well, I'd have done it slightly differently. Going slow to go fast kind of thing. Like give people that time and give yourself that time and that space. Not always be, oh, well, I need to do that and it's not going as fast, and take everything on. Give people space to kind of make their own mistakes and learn, because you'll go faster in the long run.
Yeah, completely agree. God, there's so much we could delve into there with the perfect being the enemy of the good, with learning to be comfortable with people doing things a different way. But I'm going to resist because there's other things I want to ask you. But thank you, Adam. I clearly get that impression. I guess one of the other things I've noticed about you is the amount you've raised your profile, what a lot of people might call your personal brand. You've clearly made an effort to get your voice out there with a blog, podcast, speaking appearances. I can imagine that's easier for someone like you with the bartending background. Mm-hmm. But do you think other technical leaders should overcome perhaps some of their self-doubt or limiting beliefs? I know a lot of technical leaders can think they need to be the absolute world expert mm-hmm. or something before they dare speak up. Do you think they should get over that doubt and raise their profile in the way you have?
Absolutely. So, yeah, I have a lot of strong opinions on this. I try and really push everyone I work with to do this. It kind of happened naturally for me. At Incremental, they wanted people to do videos, and lots of people are scared of doing videos. And I ended up doing them, and I found it pretty straightforward and easy to get on with. So that helped at the start. And then it kind of made sense to start reaching out to people and getting other people's ideas and being able to, like, it was like the other day I was trying to write a new technical test for a role that we're looking to hire. And so I know about 6 or 7 people that I've never worked with, but I know from communities and things, I could ping them all. I've got loads of great advice and got some example stuff that I could build from. So it is really valuable because, again, yeah, the data community is very collaborative, very supportive. But there's a really good book called Show Your Work, and I'll try and find a link for you. But it talks about this idea that you don't have to be an expert, like you said, to go and have a voice on something, and that beginners can teach other beginners. So because you have a unique, as someone that's learning a topic, you have a unique perspective for learning it, and you can teach other people that are learning at the same time. And that's actually how a lot of my technical blog posts started. I find one of the easiest ways for me to learn and remember stuff is to go and write something on it. So as I'm learning it, I'm writing a post, and you might read that as someone that doesn't know me and assume, oh, this guy knows this inside out. But it was maybe written by someone that's like only one page ahead in the manual than you are.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really valuable thing to do because it allows you to make those connections. And I think there's a lot of value in just collating the information and putting it in one easy to digest thing. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be brand new. It doesn't have to be groundbreaking. It just has to be there, and people will take it up if it's valuable to them.
Yeah, completely agree, wholeheartedly agree, Adam. And very much my own experience as well. That whole model that the completion of the learning cycle is you fully learn something by then training someone else in it. And as you say, you only have to be one page in the manual further on. You know, you're ahead of the other person. You've got value to add. And I think too many really good technical people hold themselves back from that. I guess maybe the only other tip I'd share from my experience of becoming a blogger and a podcaster is prioritize consistency in getting stuff out there. I think is a danger of feeling everything, kind of back to your point actually about managing. Everything has to be superb, world-class thought. Actually, it's much more important that people can rely on a new blog post every week or can rely on a new podcast episode every fortnight. And that consistency, I think, will give you an audience who rely on you as well.
Yeah, I was surprised to find that actually, but the numbers do sort of tell you that you being regular is very, very important, and it kind of, you build up momentum. And if you do stop, it does really suffer, like the people you reach and things like that.
Yeah, yeah, and I completely agree. I'll avoid the being regular, easy pun of prune. Let's not go there. Completely agree from my experience. And it's why I'd also encourage people to be pragmatic and realistic at the beginning as to the cadence you can commit to. You know, don't start off with loads of enthusiasm, going to be a new blog post or a new micro vlog every day, and you only keep it up for about a week. You know, it's a marathon, not a sprint kind of thing. Okay, let's come back then to what we mentioned at the beginning we'd explore a bit further, the work that you're now doing with Origami. Now, we've talked about it a bit further, and I sense that the social good that you see Origami achieving is, if I might be so rude, a bit more than the normal virtue signalling people see from companies these days, which people are a bit cynical about now, frankly, I think. Why, Adam, are you confident that the work you're doing there at Origami is really going to help other people rather than just sound good on social media?
Yeah, so I can be quite cynical about this stuff, actually. And I think that it's all well and good to be very socially conscious and driven, and lots of organizations are, but what Origami are doing is essentially the platform we are building should make short-term power trading more profitable, especially around renewables and green energy.
Right.
And I'm, yeah, again, quite cynical in thinking that if we can make it vastly more profitable to trade green energy, then actually all the activity will follow the money, and we can kind of get people doing the right thing for the wrong reasons. So that's why I think Origami is a really unique solution that's really interesting on that front. And honestly, the energy within the company, some of the people that we have are so bought into the vision and like dedicated to the cause, you could say.
Yeah.
For example, our CEO's done, like, he's a big name in the energy industry for this stuff. One of our staff just recently won a competition to go to Antarctica and look at on a leadership training course with Sir Robert Swan. And we kind of very involved with this kind of stuff to see how can we help shape the future of, yeah, like environmentalism and impact through the energy sector.
Sounds great. I guess I'm picking up, and I want to check with you whether I've got it right, that you've found real benefit from the coming together of the technical skills that Origami is clearly focusing on with your role as well, the social conscience goal, very much around environmentalism and green energy, and financial skill, knowing and understanding commercial models and how to find this kind of default action that would just make it cheaper and easier to do the right thing. Do you think if other people working in data science are looking to do something like that, they should make sure that they've got that financial and commercial side enough? Is it perhaps not just what you hear more on social media, which is really technical data scientists get involved with the charity and think about doing something good, but there's no understanding of how you make money and how to make sustainable long-term change through commercial models? Long question, Adam, but I guess, do you see that Origami is an argument for having that commercial solution, that commercial understanding as well?
So I think yes is the answer, but it's hard, right? That's hard. It's already difficult enough to get a good grounding in the fundamentals of a data science, for example, career.
Yeah.
Like learning, and like the best data scientists are always those that know their domain inside out as well and can really live in the kind of mindset of the end user and know all the specifics about their context. Mm. So trying to add in having loads of commercial understanding as well, it's a big ask, but it is one that pays off. I think it's really valuable. And that, again, so for what any one person, that's really hard, but for a team, it isn't. The idea of the full stack team, I think, is really important. And making sure you're collaborating with people that have that understanding and that vision, and that you're speaking regularly. But no, certainly worth investing time and effort in. And just understanding what you're doing is delivering value. Like, is optimizing this model any further gonna translate to real value? And one of the things I used to do with the companies we went to was get data scientists to figure out their cost per hour to the business. Like, how much does every hour of your working week cost the business, and then look at, okay, does that pay off, like, in the long term, over 18 months or whatever, with the activities you're doing? And think about that, because sometimes we can be quite guilty of really getting into the nitty gritty of the details and the technical, and back to that perfect the enemy of good. And it's about prioritization. But I think having a bit more financial acumen can't hurt, but it can be a big ask.
Yeah, that's a really pragmatic answer, Adam. Thank you for that, and agree. And maybe a call out for the importance of those more commercial analyst roles within wider data science kind of teams as well. Okay, this has been a great conversation, Adam, and thank you for everything you've been sharing with us. Final question, and one I've often, not always, but often asked guests on this podcast. Can you give us an example of something you've changed your mind on in the last 2 years, just so we get an insight into you haven't arrived at this state where you've got all wisdom? So what have you changed your mind on in recent years?
God, that's a tough one. Yeah, everything, I think. I was one of these people that thought it was all about the technology and it's all about the tools and things like that. And yeah, look, I had the intellectual snobbery that you see from a lot of people with deep academic backgrounds. And you realize that actually you really need to drill down into the why of what you're doing. Like, why have I been hired? And you haven't been hired because AI is cool. Like, that's that in some cases you might have been, but on the surface, but deep down the reason is because it's there to deliver value and things like that. So I think I've changed my mind a lot on where I fit into a team and what my role really is, and being more pragmatic about trying to contribute to the whole and not just do my thing and stay in your lane is really important, but make sure that you're aligned with the rest of the vision and the rest of the organization, and building those bigger, wider relationships. The other thing I think as a manager, I think finding that just building up a wealth of time with people that you manage, not talking about work, is a really important thing. I think it adds like a depth, especially in this kind of post-pandemic stage where like I'm a permanent from home worker now, so everything's remote. Building up time talking about non-work stuff is really important. It adds trust. It makes me a human and not just a manager. Back when I started management, very much these are the processes, these are the rules, why are we not sticking to them? And that doesn't work. Building a real relationship with people is important, so that when stuff gets tough, it's not just coming from a top-down place. It's coming from a friend and an ally saying, oh, let's do this together collaboratively. Can we find a way around this, whether that's performance management or if it's trying to move goalposts or something like that?
Yeah, no, good one, Adam. Something I've been reminded of recently by a mentoring client of mine, actually. You always learn both ways. Finding out more about one another outside the work environment and that emotional bank account stuff, as Stephen Covey would put it. So lovely. Great answers, Adam. Thank you for sharing that. And thanks for your time today, Adam, and everything you've shared with us. It has been a very enjoyable conversation. Thank you very much.
No, look, thanks very much for having me. It's been great to talk to you, and I hope it's useful to the people listening. If anyone wants to reach out to me and chat more about this stuff, I love waffling about all sorts, so feel free.
Brilliant. Thank you for the offer. I'm sure Adam Stroker will be a fairly unique name for people to find on LinkedIn, etc. And thank you, everyone, for listening. I hope you found that helpful and continue to listen to Customer Insight Leader podcast. More great interviews coming up. And each week there's also fresh content on my blog, Customer Insight Leader, or oneword.com. So you might want to check that out too. Before then, thanks everyone again for your time. Have a great week. And perhaps you can reflect on how your work aligns with your values, or what opportunities you have to use your skills as a force for good in the world today, or build the knowledge to help you do that in future. Bye for now.